CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Jonathan, can we see your phone?
Absolutely.
Amazing. Can you describe what version is this?
This is a BlackBerry Key 2. This is basically, well, this is the second last BlackBerry branded phone that exists. About two-thirds of the front of the device is the screen, and the bottom is a classic style BlackBerry keyboard.
I noticed that when you pulled it out, Charisse laughed. Do people laugh?
Can I just clarify? It was not a laugh of mockery. It was a laugh of amusement. I have not seen a BlackBerry in many years.
The BlackBerry movie.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, picture a cell phone and an email machine all in one thing. It's called a BlackBerry.
Try typing with your thumbs.
You said they were the best engineers in the world.
I said they're the best engineers in Canada.
So it's a comedy.
Oh, yeah.
I think that people, when they see these devices these days, it's an object of, if not mockery, amusement. It's not something that people take terribly seriously. But I got to tell you, I used to cover tech during the heyday of BlackBerry. And BlackBerry, not very long ago, was not a joke. This device, like the category of device, the smartphone, I don't think you could name anything else. Like, that is the device that changed the world more than any other, I think, in our lifetime. I'm not sure what you could mount a defense of that would be the device more so that like has radically transformed the world than these smartphones. And the first smartphone was the BlackBerry. It was a Canadian innovation. And it was the biggest smartphone in the world. Actually, it was the only smartphone in the world. That was not a joke when Canada was leading the future. And it was hard to imagine it going in a different direction at a certain point. That's like smartphone and BlackBerry were kind of synonymous. It did not work out that way. And so now, while Steve Jobs is sort of revered as this like magnificent figure of history, this incredible innovator, probably one of the most famous people.
Oh, yeah. Important.
In the world. Mm-hmm. Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis are not names that I think most school kids would know. But these guys are about to get a lot more well-known than they've been in many years with this movie. And again, they're doing so. The first blast of attention they're getting in years is as the subject of mockery. So they're not getting remembered for what they actually did. They're not really getting remembered as the guys who created the device that changed the world. They're instead, I think, remembered as the guys who momentarily owned the entire global smartphone market, but blew it. But did they? I don't know what's in the movie. I haven't seen the movie. The movie does not claim to be terribly faithful to the truth. But I have lived through this, as I say, as a tech journalist, though my focus was not on consumer electronics. It was hard to be covering tech in Canada at the time and not be aware of BlackBerry and what was going on. But more to the point, I have spoken to Sean Silkoff. And Sean Silkoff wrote the book that this movie is based on. He and Jackie McNish wrote the book Losing the Signal, which was all about the rise and fall of BlackBerry. So Sean and I spoke, and in a moment, I'm going to share with you some of that conversation, some reflections, and some history. Because what we're going to do today, Jonathan, Charisse, I'm going to tell you exactly how a Canadian company briefly held the world in its hands and then dropped it. Let's skip the part about who these guys really were and their biographies and their childhoods and how they came up with this amazing invention. Or at least let's gloss over all that stuff very quickly. Mike Lazaridis was born to Turkish immigrants because of Greek ancestry, born in Windsor, Ontario, and was one of these kids who's just an incredibly gifted, both in math and engineering, got really interested in computers, radio technology, by profession, electrical engineer, computer scientist. His eureka moment was actually kind of obvious, and I hesitate to make too much of it, because what was it? He knew this for years before he actually made it. He knew from a young age that whoever connected computers to wireless communications was going to cash in big. That was going to be something special. But the fact is, by the 90s, everybody knew that. The internet was already getting pretty damn big. Cell phones were getting pretty damn big. And it was kind of clear that whoever was going to smush together your chocolate with my peanut butter first and make that something that you can do on the go was going to win big. And a lot of people tried. So why did RIM succeed where so many big players fail?
What's RIM?
Oh my God, of course, people have forgotten this. BlackBerry used to be called Research in Motion. I don't know what the research was about, but the motion part I get because they were always a wireless company and they were involved. Actually, they were around for a long time before the BlackBerry. There's a whole successful history of Research in Motion before the smartphone era. But these guys were watching as the big players, the Nokias and the Motorolas, and everybody was like trying to take us, like, you know, we'd have the era of the Filofax and the personal organizer and like...
Filofax? I'm thinking like a Greek pastry. Like
it was like a book where, like... Everyone was trying to get a portable device that could do everything.
Okay.
Right? That had your calendar. I mean, that is what a smartphone is now.
Was it called the Filofax, though?
Before the electronic version, there's actually a Jim Belushi movie that all the plot revolves around a Filofax.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Don't Google that now, John.
Okay.
All the big guys were thinking maybe too far ahead because they were like, we need to get a device that does everything. And so they had these devices that did a lot of things really poorly. So how did RIM succeed? And why did RIM succeed where so many else failed? It was because they kept things simple. They focused on one killer app, email. And here is what Sean Silkoff told me about that.
This is the mid-90s when everyone is starting to use email. Hotmail is created, I think, in 1996. And by 1996-97, Research in Motion is saying we should have a device that can send emails back and forth.
That was what Mike Lazaridis innovated on. That's what he did. He built the world's first workable mobile email machine. You know, they had gone from pagers and there was a lot of pressure to stay with pagers. And he said, no, we have to be able to send and receive email on the go. And that was no small feat. Getting the antennas to be small, like tiny little modems is what RIM specialized in previously. Getting everything into this one holdable device. And of course, the keyboard. And a keyboard that, like, the ergonomics work. With two thumbs, you could type. It just worked. And they innovated with push email. And they had a very complicated back end. Like, they hosted all the stuff themselves on their own servers. And so the notion of, like, you don't have to sit there and say, get my email and wait as it very slowly delivers. Your email is kind of waiting for you.
So basically, the idea of, like, it being constantly connecting and you get the email moments after it's sent on a regular basis as opposed to having to manually refresh.
That's right. And that notion of constant connectivity is, I think, one of the kind of defining ways that our lives were changed. A lot of it had to do not just with the efficiency and the miniaturization of the hardware, but the data. Because if you think about what networks were able to handle at the time, remember that detail. Keeping things as small as possible was a big key to their success. As for Jim Balsillie, he wasn't the technologist. He was the business person of the bunch. And, you know, I can only infer from the previews of this movie, he's portrayed as this aggressive shark of a business person. Is he an inventor? Is he an innovator? Should he be celebrated? I think you can't tell the story of the BlackBerry without talking about his contribution.
Who was Balsillie? Was he like the CEO of RIM?
So these guys ultimately were co-CEOs. But I'll back up and I'll give you a little bit more of who is Balsillie. The top level parts of his biography will just sound like a typical Canadian establishment blue blood, right? This guy, Harvard Business School, before that Trinity College. Before that, he literally played lacrosse and hockey with George Cope, the future CEO of Bell Canada, and Wade Oosterman. It's like almost like they had like a future telecom executive boys club. He was a hard partier. His nickname was Balls. But he is not exactly the stereotype blue blood that may be described by all that.
They didn't call him Silly Balls?
Oh, it's perfect.
If we could turn back time. But listen to this. At Trinity College, his squad was actually kind of interesting. Here's who he hung out with. Malcolm Gladwell.
Of course he hung out with Malcolm Gladwell.
Adam Egoyan. Jim Balsillie actually acted in an Adam Egoyan student film called A Clockwork Trinity.
Oh, my God.
And then there were people who you might expect as part of this group. Andrew Coyne was there. Nigel Wright, future...
Chief of Staff to Harper?
Waylon Smithers to Harper's, okay. Mr. Burns, yes. Balsillie also has Métis heritage. His dad is Métis. And interesting family history. His grandmother on that side of the family once managed exotic dancers in Winnipeg and was known as the Queen of the Strippers. The book posits that maybe Balsillie was like a tryhard because he was a little bit of a fish out of water amongst all of those other guys. He was a bit more working class in his background. Fast forward, he muscles his way into an equal partnership with Lazaridis into the early research in motion. Famously, he mortgages his house to do so. There are two things in the history of BlackBerry that, above anything else, you have to credit Balsillie with in terms of what led to the success. The first one was that he is the one who carved out the deal with the telecom carriers, who really had no idea at the time what to do with wireless data networks.
By the early 90s, there was a lot of promise and hype and hope about wireless data, but no one could figure out what the market was. You had these two wireless data networks that were ancient and tiny in terms of their capacity by today's standards, but they were empty. No one could figure out what to do with them. So that's when the folks at Research in Motion said, okay, well, how about we do wireless email and we'll rent some of your space on your network? And Bell South was so strapped for cash for its wireless data network that they took the $5 or $6 million that RIM was offering just to sell a bit of time and fill up this vast empty network that they were having difficulty selling into.
I find that really interesting that, you know, and I remember that time when like your cell phone, your flip phone, whatever would have like, you could like pay money for a ringtone or something like that's what they were doing with data. And I guess this was a deal that they couldn't resist just to get free cash.
Why did these data networks exist if no one was using them?
They didn't know yet. And in Silkoff and McNish's book, they talk about how like they were trying everything. In fact, RIM was involved in one of these experiments. There was an early payment system at Skydome for like your hot dogs. Rogers tried to use wireless data networks to predict when delivery trucks were going to arrive. And then they brought it to the consumer. But when it was the wireless carriers trying to offer you, you know, data products, well, how good are they going to be at that? You know, so what you had was these wireless data networks kind of sitting dormant, and there was an opportunity there that they saw, if we can actually just get the space and manage it ourselves, we can do something with this. So that was one business innovation. The other major thing you got to credit Balsillie with was his marketing strategy. And here, Charisse, I'll ask you to read this passage from Losing the Signal.
The solution, Lazaridis and Balsillie decided, was an unorthodox plan to infiltrate Fortune 1000 companies. RIM made it easy for influential managers and executives to link the addictive BlackBerry system into their corporate email without involving the IT department. RIM even priced the devices so they fell within executives' discretionary spending budgets. The idea was to get a critical mass of top executives in a company to use BlackBerries before their CIO realized a new technology had infiltrated the business.
So those are the two innovations Balsillie brought from a business perspective. First off, he was able to basically buy from Bell South the wireless data network capacity that the carrier didn't know what to do with. And he was able to get this thing popularized by just putting it in hands, either by making it as cheap as possible or giving it away for free to top-level executives. And if you think about that, once your boss is hooked to, like, always-on-the-go email, as we all are now, but once your boss is hooked to it, they are expecting to be replied to.
Oh, so it's his fault.
Oh, yeah. You know, you basically make their efficiency. First of all, you turn them into an employee who is never not working and somebody who is communicating constantly around the clock and expecting to get replies on the same schedule. And after that, yeah, it's going to just proliferate throughout these companies.
Wow. Somehow it didn't occur to me that this could all be pinned at the hands of one person.
It also seems like they were trying to just sort of do this backdoor access to these executives without going around the official sort of technology IT channels.
For sure, yeah. Because when you deal with the IT department, they're like, well, we have to support this. We have to do tech support for this. We have to change our whole system. But this was an infiltration attempt.
Yeah.
And it was very deliberate. It was very intentional.
What a monster. No, but like there are laws across the world to try to undo this.
In any event, BlackBerry becomes incredibly popular amongst the jet set business class, not just executives, but also world leaders. And one key moment in the history of BlackBerry and the smartphone, as Sean told me, was 9/11.
I mean, the only way people could communicate after the towers were hit were by BlackBerries. And in Washington, you know, this company had tried hard to get into official Washington with very limited success. And on that day, when the plane hit the Pentagon, that knocked out communications as well. In Washington, the only people who could communicate were the people who had BlackBerries. And one of the first things that happened when Washington got back to business a few weeks later was every member of the House of Representatives was issued a BlackBerry, and suddenly BlackBerries were used to convey global secrets. I mean, this was... You know, this is a company whose devices were, think about it, carried the secrets of presidents and princesses, CEOs and celebrities. I mean, it really did change the world.
I find that so interesting, both that, like, there's this period where the Pentagon is hit and communications are out, and the only communication that's happening amongst Washington power people is over these BlackBerries.
Why was that?
When the third plane attacked the Pentagon, that knocked out most cellular and landline phones for people who are working in government. Communications down the chain of command went dead, writes Sean in his book. And the only way people were able to communicate was over their BlackBerries. And it's also interesting to know that once you've got all of these different elected representatives in the states and all these world leaders, all those secrets, as Sean says, are going through these servers in Waterloo. So that really establishes the BlackBerry as the device of choice for this type of person. And pretty soon we've got Barack Obama coming into office. And one of the major narratives is that he's either smoking his Newports or he's on his BlackBerry. And he's got a whole fight with the Secret Service over about whether he can keep it or not. And he wins that fight. And that's when we see CrackBerry entering the lexicon. And it just goes like juggernaut from there. They created the smartphone market and owned it. And they had 50% of the global cell phone market. I mean, even iPhone doesn't have that now. Nobody has anything remotely close to that. And then they f*** all up. And nobody can agree on why that happened or if it could have been avoided. But there are theories. Why did they f*** it all up? Let's count the theories. Okay, theory one. They just got soft. And here, I think that there is a very strong Canadian element to this particular theory. By 2007, when the iPhone is released, RIM is an absolute darling of a company in Canada. They have been celebrated, the co-CEOs, Vasily and Lazaridis, for years. This is a phenomenon. This is the pride of our nation. And the co-founders were crowned and anointed and in every way imaginable. And they were used to that kind of life. Jim becomes a philanthropist. He founds the Balsillie School of International Affairs, the University of Waterloo, the Center for International Governance and Innovation think tank. He donates all this money for a Balsillie Family Hospital wing. Honorary degrees from Wilfrid Laurier University, Dalhousie, U of T, Trent University. He is an honorary captain of the Royal Canadian Navy. And Sean told me this anecdote about how the first time he actually met Balsillie, it was at the Chateau Laurier Hotel in Ottawa, and Balsillie is wearing a full naval uniform. I think this is a very Canadian thing, that once you are in the top level of establishment, it's very comfortable. I mean, Steve Jobs had also had a lot of success by the time he came up with the iPhone, but there's a different attitude, I think, when you are in a very competitive atmosphere with other people who are trying to take it all away from you. And he'd already lost a lot and had to fight to get it back. These guys were hella comfortable and maybe distracted. Balsillie had a wild hair up his ass about buying a hockey team. He wanted to buy an NHL team and move it to Hamilton. And he tried that three times. It did not work out.
Which team did he want to buy?
The Pittsburgh Penguins, the Nashville Predators, and the Phoenix Coyotes.
Wait, he wanted to buy American teams and bring them to Hamilton?
He did, and he had to be coy about it and at times promise that he wouldn't bring them to Hamilton. And then he was discovered to already be selling tickets. And his bid was rejected by the NHL with prejudice.
I see.
He failed to pass what they called their character test for reasons that will soon become clear. As for Mike Lazaridis, he too was enjoying his perch. He was made in 2006 an officer of the Order of Canada. He was also a member of the Order of Ontario. And he also starts this phase of like, now I'm going to give back and be this sort of lion champion of research. He founded the Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics, the Institute for Quantum Computing. So maybe by this point, there was a hubris to them. They had already done it. And the idea that anybody could come take it from them, I think, wasn't contemplated. And perhaps there was also an arrogance to them. And
perhaps. Famously. That's like the premise of the movie, I assume. There's this amazing detail in this Bloomberg Business Week story from a decade ago. And there was this one person, one former executive there, who told this quick story. One thing we missed out on was that Justin Bieber wanted to rep BlackBerry. This is 2007-2008, the peak Bieber. He said, give me $200,000 and 20 devices and I'm your brand ambassador, basically. And we pitched that to marketing. Here's a Canadian kid. He grew up here. All the teeny boppers will love that. They basically threw us out of the room. They said, this kid is a fad. He's not going to last. I said at the meeting, this kid might outlive Rim. Everyone laughed.
I think that their tone deafness for things cultural is a theme that's going to come up again here.
Yeah.
They were proudly Canadian in a way that you could describe as arrogant. They were not watching the world for what the world's next move was on their space. They actually expected the world to come to them.
They were very proud of being Canadian. I mean, Jim had even said, you know, when Americans would call up and say, oh, we'd love to meet with you, you know, investors or iBankers or other technology companies, Jim would say, great, when are you going to be in Waterloo next? Like, you know, Waterloo is where it's happening. You know, he wanted to send the message, you know, we're here. We're not going to come at the drop of a hat down to Manhattan or Silicon Valley to grovel.
So that's theory one. They got soft. Here's theory two. Lennon and McCartney had a fight and broke up. Jim kind of broke the law. Rim kind of broke the law, but Jim knew about it and was a part of it. What he did was he backdated stock options. So what that is when you're trying to entice people to be executives, you give them stock options that allow them to buy your company's stock dated to a certain point in time. So even though the stock may have skyrocketed, they can buy them when their option comes up for what it was worth at an earlier date. And they change those documents. They changed the documents in a way that benefited Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis for millions of dollars, but also lots of other executives. There was an email chain that came up where they were, you know, asking other people to like change the dates on documents so that they could buy them for a price based on a time when the stock was worth less. But it is illegal and something that, it should be said, kind of everybody was doing. He's never been charged or convicted of a crime. This is a securities violation by billionaires, so it's not going to be a criminal matter. But it was pursued, and then it was settled with a hefty payoff. Jim never claimed to be innocent. He never claimed that he never did it. He said he didn't know it was wrong or something like that. This may sound like a routine thing in the history of any company of this scale, that shit like this happens. It's like lawsuits, some security stuff. Find me a company where this hasn't happened. But for the relationship between Mike Lazaridis and Jim Balsillie, this actually is what broke up the marriage. This is why mommy and daddy don't talk anymore. What Mike Lazaridis had to say about this after he had to give testimony and felt like, you know, it's been a long time since anyone's spoken to him harshly, and here he's getting deposed and asked all these bracing questions, and he was furious with Jim. And his point of view on this was, I don't know anything about this. For years now, I just signed what you put in front of me. How could you put me in this position? Jim's position was one of equal feelings of betrayal, of like, I have made so many moves to make you a gazillionaire, and now one thing goes sideways, and you are shocked and appalled, and your monocle is falling out. I asked Sean Silkoff why these two guys, who had done so well by working together, why would they let something so seemingly minor break up the band? And he agreed that it had a lot to do with their reputations. This was really the first mark against them. And they had come to really, really, really care about their legacy, their reputation, their record.
I think that was the case for Mike in particular. And then it turned out to be a key pivot point. And interestingly, it's also, you know, I mean, the film adaptation, obviously, it's going to be different than the book. They have 2 hours to tell a story. It's a piece of cinema as opposed to a book. But it's interesting that they also glommed onto that as a central point in the story and make that a core theme of the story.
And, you know, the board demanded that Balsillie step down as the CEO after that. And they basically lost control of the company in the wake of that relationship getting...
Yeah, so essentially what we're looking at is two people who got real comfortable in their own success and this idea that they were these two great, amazing tech guys and then got caught for something that they never thought they would get caught for.
And all the while unaware that something was about to smack down from the heavens right on their head.
Yep.
Which brings us to Theory 3. It was the iPhone, stupid.
Is a revolutionary mobile phone. Three things. A widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communications device. These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone.
So Steve Jobs rolls out the iPhone. The press calls it the Jesus phone. And it is clear to everyone in the world, except for BlackBerry, that this is a game changer.
To rivals such as RIM, Nokia, and Motorola, the iPhone's popularity was illogical. Its battery lasted less than 8 hours. It operated on an older, slower second-generation network, and as Letteritis predicted, music, video, and other downloads strained AT&T's network. RIM now faced an adversary it didn't understand. By all rights, the product should have failed, but it did not, said David Yock, RIM's chief technology officer.
Everything that Mike Lazaridis as an engineer toiled to perfect when he created the BlackBerry, the iPhone sucked at. You know, battery power? The first BlackBerry lasted a month on one AA battery.
Oh, I forgot. It lasted forever. That was a thing.
Monochrome screen. Like this was a functional business tool, and it would last for almost a month. The iPhone, you have to plug it in every day. So as an engineer, he's like, what a piece of shit. It's an energy hog. Yeah. Data efficiency, forget it. Like, this guy had struggled to get the bits as small and efficient and elegantly moving around so that you could just rely on your email communication. The iPhone is a monster. Music files, pictures, video. No cellular network, he thought, could handle this thing. Consumers are going to get killed on their bills. The networks are going to crash. And the price... the price was absurd because the BlackBerry, you remember, like, this was a product for rich people, for people in suits, and it cost $350 for an entry-level BlackBerry at the time. The iPhone is debuted as a product that's basically pitched to hipsters and priced at $499. Who's going to buy that? Who needs a $499 phone? So when you consider their initial take on the iPhone, that this isn't a threat because all the things the BlackBerry excels at, the iPhone sucks at, they were 100% right about all of that. It just didn't matter.
And that's one of the most amazing things. They were right about every single one. You know, the AT&T network crashed from so much Apple use, there were lawsuits.
BlackBerry was now on its back foot. Jim and Mike were no longer in agreement with each other about the path forward, and their board was rapidly losing confidence in both of them. And this is when they started to chase trends instead of setting trends.
What did BlackBerry do? BlackBerry said, well, this is interesting. Let's develop a touchscreen phone, but it's going to be the BlackBerry version of a touchscreen phone. And their device was called the Storm. So instead of doing everything tapping this magic software on your screen, the actual screen is a giant button. And so when you want to tap a letter, you'll click down and the entire button, the entire screen, which is floating on top of the device, will click down and you'll just click. And it's like, oh, yeah. I'm a BlackBerry user. I can relate to this smartphone because it makes a clicking sound. They didn't have enough time to develop it properly. This was new technology, a new approach. And so it was very buggy and it flopped and it just felt like dead technology. So that was the first mistake they made. The second mistake they made was instead of abandoning it and going all in on a touchscreen, Mike decided he wanted to perfect it. He said, well, let's fix the bugs and then the Storm will be great. So we did a Storm 2 and they were already working on Storm 3 when one of the carriers said, you know what, just give us a touchscreen phone. So they lost about a year and a half doing that. And then they thought their problem was the browser. And so they lost some time on that. And then they couldn't make the decision on what to do about what operating system to build. And they wasted time on that. So by the time that BlackBerry comes out with a full touchscreen phone with proper underlying software is early 2013. And that is like 6 years after the iPhone had appeared. You don't have 6 years in technology to come up with a proper response. And I think the roots of that were the fact that they were doing it from Canada and that they were so mired in what had been, you know, very successful thinking and product strategies for so many years that they didn't realize or appreciate how much the paradigm had changed and that they just had to do everything in an entirely different way from the word go. And they didn't.
They then chased Apple on another product. They put out this atrocious tablet with a late and inferior product. And then there was this hilarious period where finally they're like, maybe we have to actually try to make this cool and hip and make this a lifestyle product. And they tried to like out-Apple Apple with marketing. They named Alicia Keys their global creative director.
Oh, I remember that.
Amazing.
I remember that. So it's 2013. It says Alicia Keys is cool, but she's, you know, it was an odd choice.
The kids love her. You know who else?